meeting and put it online for the... We have a couple of people who like to listen to it that can't be here. So it'll be available online. I think everybody's signed. So welcome to the Heathen Collection. why don't we just go around real quick? We have a lot of new people, and give a 1 minute summary of who they are and why they're here. And I'll start. My name's Henry. I've been here for a couple of years now. I've been an atheist ever since my catechism teacher told me you're not allowed to ask that question. And this is Ron.
Me? Yes, Ron Avery. I'm a founding member of this group, as a matter of fact. I think I'm the only one here that that was here the very first time.
No, I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, yes, you were, Sir John. I'm sorry. Yeah. And what else do you want to know? I'm very old.
Aren't we
older than most of you, all of you. But I sort of try and hang in there.
Okay. I'm Sherry Martinez. I'm a recovering Catholic. Probably the same issue. They kicked my older brother out of the Catholic high school for asking questions. I actually told the sister that they were really sisters, since Adam and Eve was all the mama and daddy. So that's how I got. So I actually married someone here. I used to teach English here 35 years ago, and I married someone from here, and we went to the States, and we came back 5 years ago, built a house, and now we live here permanently.
That's cool.
Well, I'm John Dewall. I have been an atheist for as long as I can remember. Actually, I'm an ethical humanist, really, and the atheist part is just part of it that I never gave that much thought. So anyway, it's the result of having a Catholic father and a Protestant mother who loved each other and decided to give up on religion.
I am Cy Seifried, and I started gravitating towards being an atheist after age 12, when in Sunday school I asked, who wrote the Bible? And I never get an answer.
I'm Phil Rylett, inveterate skeptic. I became an atheist when I read the Bible.
Keith Foster. I don't claim relation to any religion. I wouldn't call myself a true atheist. I lived here for about the last 5 years. Before that, we were in Mexico City for 40 hours. And we're here permanently.
I'm Gary Fish, friends of Phil and Sandy. Been here 5 years and been enlightened a lot by Phil especially. And him and I have had good discussions at Re-Science. But, we'll just come to hear Sandy's talk today.
Thank you. I'm Sandy. I'm going to be talking today, and I was also raised Catholic. It must be about Catholicism that if you have a tendency for it to break, that'll break it.
I'm Leah, Gary's wife. I'm an atheist for sure. Probably from way back. My grandfather ran after a priest with an axe. So he's got excommunicated. So I guess he runs in a family.
This is an interesting story.
Yeah, he was next to the cemetery. Yeah. Anyway, that's my story.
I'm Olin Foster. Keith already introduced himself, my hobby. I was brought up Church of England until I was about 12, and then had a very interesting time looking at going to different churches. The one I could relate to the nearest was Swedenborg, or New Church. I do believe there's one or two in the States, New Jerusalem. That was the nearest, but I'm a big believer in spiritualism, and it should be interesting. I love to listen to Sandy's talks.
I'm John, and I survived Catholic school, and never really thought of myself as an atheist, but as I started looking into it and reading Dawkins' book, man, I realized that's probably why.
That is so, I am so sorry. There's a little edge right there.
Oh my god.
It's the ghost. The ghost.
That's intriguing.
You have been struck down.
So could you just briefly introduce yourself?
My name is Lori Chevoyan, and I live in Ikeek now, but I'm from Florida in the United States, and I'm Roman Catholic. Are we talking about this? Okay.
Let's hope you have Lori, don't worry.
Yeah.
Judging by the rest
for
of
you. For all of you, yeah?
Yeah.
Shall I ask someone to turn the camera?
Yes.
Yes.
That would be good.
I don't want to open this call to anyone.
So I don't think I need to give you the obligatory 80 peso message because everybody's at least into 80 pesos by now. So we have a presentation from Sandy. And you go, girl.
Okay. If everybody's ready. Okay. So if those of you who saw the announcement saw that my presentation is called Believing is Seeing, which I will explain. I'm going to be talking about beliefs. Some of you may have heard the story of the Cottingley Fairies. In 1917, a couple of girls cut little pictures of fairies out of one of their books and went down to their garden and took photos and announced to the world that there were fairies living in the bottom of their garden. And some newspapers picked up on this and started running the photos. Other ones said, nah, nah, nah. But the story got a big boost from an unexpected source. A very famous literary figure of the day, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, believed in the fairies. And he put his, you know, his name behind it, and so then a lot of other people started running this story about the fairies. Now, a lot of people don't know that Arthur Conan Doyle was a spiritualist. I'm not sure when he became one, if it was in relation to writing Sherlock Holmes, because Sherlock Holmes, one of the most famous literary figures, certainly in the English language, was a total rationalist, right? So how he could write these stories of a total rationalist and still be a spiritualist, I'm not sure how that hung together. But some people say he became a spiritualist after the death of his son in World War I, which is a very common reason to become one, is the desire to communicate with someone who's gone. He became friends with Harry Houdini for the same reason. Houdini's mother died, and he wanted to communicate with his mother. So with Conan Doyle, he attended various seances and things like that. Now, Houdini immediately dismissed it all as fraud because he was an illusionist and he knew how easy it was to, you know, create this illusion. He dismissed it as fraud and it eventually ended the friendship between the two men. Interestingly, Conan Doyle claimed that Houdini really was psychic. You know, some of the psychic tricks he did. Houdini repeatedly denied it, but Conan Doyle kept insisting he really was. I mean, that's really interesting, too. Okay? But Conan Doyle, in being, that, you know, he was, went to some seances with a couple of spiritualist sisters who were later debunked as a fraud. But in being drawn into that, he was a victim to the same thinking errors as the rest of us. We all have thinking errors, okay? We're essentially made that way, and that's kind of what I want to talk about today. I thought this would be a good group to talk about it with because I'm assuming that this group favors rational analysis over gut feelings or blind faith, okay? At least most people who are in here now. And so, even if you do like faith, there are thinking errors that interfere with our daily lives that it's good to know about them and try to overcome them. Okay, now, this is a talk on beliefs, and talking about beliefs is difficult because you end up going back to, for instance, scientific studies and saying things like, scientists believe, you know, and all beliefs are open to question. So I'm going to be giving you kind of the current neurological thinking on beliefs, the current thinking of cognitive scientists and neurologists. It could change in a year, it could change in 5 years, it has changed over the centuries, you know, as they gain more information. And also, I'm going to be using anecdotes, but I want to make it clear, I don't consider anecdotes to be proof of anything. I'm just using them to illustrate what I'm talking about, okay? To give an example. So what is a belief? Now, strangely, when I went to start researching this, I had a really hard time finding a definition of belief. from a cognitive science or neurological point of view. And but this is what I kind of pulled out of several different things that I was reading. Okay, belief is a mental construct used to represent reality. Something inside our heads, but it represents what we consider to be external reality. Okay? The thinker is confident that it does represent reality. Okay, so if I rub this window and I say, oh, that's smooth, my fingers feel that it's smooth, I'm pretty certain that in reality this thing is smooth. This window exists and it's smooth, right? They live in the unconscious mind. Neurologists in general are pretty sure that everything lives in the unconscious mind. And some things trickle up and become conscious. Everything starts in the unconscious mind. Some things trickle up and become conscious. We only are conscious of what we're conscious of. So that makes it really interesting because you don't know what's happening below the surface, okay? But we don't have to be aware of them for them to be beliefs. We have many, many unconscious beliefs that we operate on all the time that we aren't even really consciously aware of. Once we believe something, we cease to test its validity. Okay, we just operate on the assumption that this is true, unless something major happens to contradict it. And even that, we're, as human beings, we're very, very good at finding reasons why that thing didn't contradict our current beliefs and holding on to our current beliefs. Okay, we're very, very good at changing our perception of things, filtering our perceptions to shove them back into our current concept of what we believe. And that's where my title came from, Believing is Seeing. Because if you already have a concept in your mind, you're gonna tend to see the world that way. And it's very, very difficult to change. Okay? And one thing I want to clarify is that I'm going to be talking about belief. Today I'm going to talk about belief in phenomena as opposed to philosophy. So philosophy would be like, I believe Bernie Sanders could have won the election. Or I believe drugs should be legalized. Okay, that's philosophy. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about whether what things you believe exist, the nature of reality, okay? Whether certain things happened or didn't, whether certain things can or can't happen. So what do humans believe in? So we believe in, first of all, we have this big base layer of all the things we believe in our daily experience, things that we no longer test the validity of. I believe if I drop a ball, it will fall. I believe if I walk off a cliff, I will fall. Okay? I don't test that. I don't walk off cliffs. I believe that, right? It's part of my everyday experience. But there's a lot of stuff that we believe that was basically told or taught to us. And so, for instance, there are things that have scientific consensus. And I got some statistics on how many people believe in these things that have scientific consensus. So, for instance, this is the United States. Evolution, 60% of people in the United States believe in evolution. 40% don't, okay? And usually they believe in like an intelligent design or a creation or something like that. 62% believe in climate change. That was the most recent figure I could find, and that was more than I actually thought. That's been growing. But only 13% believe that there's a scientific consensus of climate scientists about climate change. I've even read articles that dispute whether there's a consensus about climate change. So, once again, it's like, what, you know, who do you believe? 75% of Americans believe that the Earth revolves around the sun. The other 25% believe the sun revolves around the Earth. Now, when I'm thinking belief, is they really believe it or are they just misinformed? And if somebody said, no, here's, or maybe they even misunderstood the question, revolves around, what does that mean, you know? If somebody showed them, they might say yes. But I thought that was a really interesting statistic. 83% believe that vaccines are safe or at least worth the risk, that they're far safer than risking the disease. 83, that's pretty good. But still 17 is enough to eliminate herd immunity. So it's kind of a scary thing for those of you who are up on this, okay? 93% of Americans believe the moon landing happened. This is interesting. Depending on the poll, 25 to 50% of Brits believe it was faked. 25 to 50%. And I don't know what it is in other countries. It's like, and I have no idea why they believe it was faked or, you know. I mean, that's super interesting.
Well, their television wasn't working.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
We don't trust.
Well, they believe it was fake. So they filmed, and they've set up a sound stage and filmed it, you know, and they have all these reasons why they think it's fake. I read a really interesting article by somebody. It was a comment in, you know, somebody was investigating the flat earthers, I think, and it was a comment by a moon landing hoaxer who believed the moon landing was a hoax, who said, how could you ever catch up to the moon if the earth is going 76,000 miles an hour? Okay, and so it's like, okay. But I just wrote, you have such a, you know, such a staggeringly bad concept of physics that I'm not even going to try to explain it to you. But it's, so it's interesting to get, you know, and to him it's like, well, this way, yeah, 76,000 miles an hour, how could that ever happen? Okay. So now I'm going to talk about things people believe in without scientific consensus, things that the scientific community don't believe exist. Or we would say experts on the subtopic don't believe exist. So that could include things like alternative medicine, conspiracy theories, and certain types of alternative medicine. I'm not going to say everything. Conspiracy theories, extraterrestrials, do extraterrestrials exist? Well, the majority of astronomers believe yes. You know, and biologists too. There's extraterrestrial life. But whether they ever got into a saucer-shaped ship and tried to come to Earth, that's a completely different thing, okay? Then there's the what we would call the supernatural. Some people say, well, it's really only the natural that we haven't explained yet, because if it exists, it's part of the natural world. But some people believe it's on a different plane or a different, you know, existence in the natural world. So in the United States, once again, depending on the poll, 80 to 90% of people believe in God. Okay? They start with 90 who say yes, they do, but it turns to 80 if you phrase it a little different way and say, are you sure? Do you have any doubts? It goes down to 80. Okay?
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? And some of them may still go to a church, and I'll talk about that a little bit. Okay, 77% believe that angels exist and aid human beings on Earth. Only 34% in ghosts. I was very surprised about that because I know lots and lots of people who just take ghosts as an absolute given. 41% in ESP. 65% believe that Ouija boards are dangerous. And I have to believe that came from, you know, I would love to see that statistic before the movie The Exorcist came out, you know, and because so many horror movies now have evil spirits being led in through a Ouija board. Only 25% believe in astrology, which I also find surprising because I know lots of people believe in it. 54% believe that alien life has visited Earth, and 25% in a homeopathy. I think that's higher here. Higher here in IE than 25%. And homeopathy, I'm talking about strict homeopathy, the dilute, and it retains the spirit or whatever. I'm not talking about like herbal medicine and stuff. A lot more people believe in that. Okay, so that's just some idea of some of the things people believe in. Now, the benefits of belief. Why do we have beliefs? Okay, so first, full disclosure, I believe in evolution. So I always look for evolutionary reasons why humans do what they do. And obviously so do neuroscientists and cognitive scientists. And the first thing we all have to recognize is that the brain is a survival machine. Okay, and it wants us to survive. It wants us to survive in service of our genes, not in service of us. It wants us to live long enough to reproduce and raise those kids to the point where they can reproduce. Okay, so that's what it's going for. So why do we have beliefs? Well, basically the brain wants to have a mental construct of reality already built so that you can react quickly to things. If you had to go around pondering everything you did in your everyday life, you would not survive. Okay, so it has to build all these concepts and constructs, and then it holds on to them because they work. And that's, you know, that's basically how you survive. But that trickles over into believing in all these other things too. It doesn't just limit itself to survival. Okay, so some of the things, for instance, you have a mental construct of is your ability to recognize faces, your ability to recognize threats when a situation looks dangerous or when it looks safe. Just doing the activities you have to do to survive every day. So every time I went to drop something, I had to wonder whether it was actually going to fall or not. I would have a very hard time getting through my day. You know, you have to basically have these constructs. Some other reasons, and these are more, this first reason applies to every sentient creature. Every sentient creature has to have a mental construct to go about its life. But humans, because we're conscious, it may give us a greater sense of control over a very scary world. So that in situations where we would otherwise give up hope, we can, for instance, start appealing to the gods, and that gives us the persistence to go on and keep trying, okay? And you'll hear that all the time. We've done everything we can, now all we can do is pray. You know, so it's that, you know, it's that last thing that you can do when you've exhausted all the others. Okay, a really big reason is for social bonding. We are tribal, so we tend to believe in the things that our tribe believes in, which we can see very clearly in the United States right now what's happening, okay? And we want to stay members of our tribe, so we do not want to stop believing in those things, okay? And it's the same with being a member of a religion. It's the same with being a member of a group like this. We're tribal. We want to find other people who share our beliefs, and then once we're a member of that tribe, we want to stick with those beliefs. Okay, we're a social creatures, and it's very, very important to us. Okay, so that's why sometimes people can stay with a religion even when they've quit believing in God, because it's a tribe. It's a social support group. Okay, I have a statistic down here further, which I went, oh yeah, 60. So for instance, in a Gallup survey, they found that 65% of Israelis, the Jewish state, are either not religious or convinced atheists. 65%. And apparently there's constant tension between the seculars and the religious. Constant tension. There's constant fights over whether the law should reflect the Jewish religion or whether the law should be secular. Okay? So I find that very interesting. But if you ask them, almost all of them are going to say, I'm Jewish. Right? They're not going to, they're convinced atheists, but they're going to say, I'm Jewish, because they belong to the Jewish tribe. They belong to the Jewish culture. They still celebrate the Jewish traditions and rituals, because that gives them that sense of tribe. You know, so you don't necessarily have to believe in a God or the God that everybody else believes in to want to be part of the tribe. Right? Okay, and another thing it does is helps alleviate negative emotions like grief that might otherwise be debilitating. So if somebody, grief is a very powerful emotion. If somebody can believe my loved one went on to a better place and I'll see them again, then maybe that gives them the strength that they don't just collapse and quit wanting to live. Okay? So those are some of the reasons that biologists and neuroscientists put out that we have belief, that it benefits us. Where do we get our beliefs? Well, really interesting, there's a certain amount of evidence that we're pre-programmed to believe in certain things, to understand reality in a certain way. So, for instance, babies, and it's very hard to study babies because they can't tell you what they're thinking. They're not very cooperative. You can't put them in an MRI machine or something like that. So they've developed all these clever ways of trying to figure out what babies know and don't know. But babies seem to have, for instance, a built-in fear of abandonment, which would mean death, right? Or of heights. You know, they seem to know the first time they encounter a steep edge that they shouldn't go over it. You know, so there may be a certain amount built into our brains. We also may have a genetic predisposition, by which I mean our DNA may give us a predisposition to believe or not believe. And a lot of you have said it runs in the family, right? Now, it could be that the family is teaching you their beliefs, but it could be there's also a certain predisposition, a genetic predisposition in your family to believe or not believe. My mother was a believer, my father wasn't. You know, I'm not. Did I get that from him? Interestingly, when I was 25 before they raised us Catholic, because my father agreed to do that for my mother's sake. I was 25 before I told him I was an atheist, and he just got this, this sense of relief. Oh, so am I. And I'd never known in my entire life that he was. You know, but I kind of, well, that's interesting, you know. So he hadn't taught me, but, you know, I shared that with him, okay. Your brain structure and chemistry can affect your beliefs. Okay, so depending on what, you know, neurotransmitters and stuff are going on in your brain at any given time, or you all know, religious experience on drugs and stuff like that, so your brain chemistry can really affect what you believe in. Belief is built up by the experience of daily life. So what babies don't know when they're born, they're very, very motivated to find out. They're constantly, they're little scientists, they're constantly exploring the world and trying to figure out how everything works. And they're building that mental picture of reality the whole time. And obviously we believe what we're taught, by especially by authority figures or as part of our tribal identity. So I found, for instance, a really interesting, I don't know if any of you ever seen Michael Moore's, what is it, Bowling for Columbine? Okay, where he explores why is the United States so obsessed with guns? And he can't find a reason, because every reason he finds, other countries share it, but they aren't obsessed with guns. You know, other countries have had like a Wild West. Other countries, you know, have crime rates and stuff like that, but they aren't obsessed with guns. And one thing I saw said that they believe that guns were a social signaling device. Essentially, and that's one of the reasons people want to open carry. By having a gun or carrying a gun, you're saying, I'm this tribe. I'm the gun tribe. See, and it connects you to all those other people. And it tends to go with a whole set of beliefs that, you know, being a gun fan tends to go with a whole set of beliefs. So once again, it gets back to tribal identity and what these people learned while they were growing up. I mean, I imagine if you grew up in a very pro-gun family and you come out against it, you know, it's like you're gone, you know, and you don't want that to happen. Okay? So then there's intuition and personal preference. Everybody I've ever talked to about their religious beliefs, and I don't know many fundamentalists, so it may be different fundamentalists, have adjusted what they were taught to make themselves happy. Okay? So you say the Christian religion believes that men should dominate the family and women should be subservient. Oh, I don't believe that. I don't think that's true. Okay? I say, if I'm an atheist, am I going to go to hell? Well, I think if you're a good person, even though the Christian, you know, the Bible specifically says you're going to go to hell, I think if you're a good person, you'll be all right. Okay? So I think everybody, I'm not making fun of anybody. Everybody does this. Everybody adjusts what they were taught to the point that they're comfortable with. I call it the church of me. Essentially, everybody belongs to the church of me. You know, that they've adjusted everything to their whatever, for whatever reason, their personal preference. And then there's extraordinary experiences. Trauma, drugs, psychosis, religious experiences. My first mother-in-law became bipolar when she took amphetamine-based diet drugs. They were legal. They were drugstore diet drugs. But, you know, with the, I don't know if they have epinephrine or something in them. And it put her into a permanent bipolar state. I mean, it's now being controlled by drugs. But she started hearing God talking to her. And God said really interesting things. She would talk about what God was saying to her. And I found it all very intriguing. But at the same time, you know, they put her in a mental hospital for a couple weeks to get her squared away, because she was ready to give away the house to, you know, anybody who wanted it. And she was taking in people off the street that she had no idea and stuff like that. And then there's paranormal experiences. So there's a lot of biological reasons that people see ghosts or feel out of body. You know, all those have been explained. But if you have one, you had one, you know. And most people who have had one are going to feel like, well, now I believe it. Okay? And then there's other people in media, especially the social media. And that's one of the things I thought would be a good discussion at the end of this, is the effect the digital age, the internet, the mass media has had on people's beliefs, on essentially cementing people into their tribes, you know, by exposing them to, you know, maybe conspiracy theories and all the reasons behind the conspiracy theory that they might not have ever thought of before, that type of thing. Okay, so what are the drawbacks of believing? Well, beliefs can distort reality. So you can actually believe in something that's not true, and you can be operating on that. Of course, I don't have a specific example of that. But for one thing would be what's called negativity bias, which is that humans and most creatures, I'm not even going to say just sentient creatures, live in kind of a permanent state of anxiety. Okay, and Do you guys know who Michael Shermer is? I would think most freethinkers know who Michael Shermer is. Okay. Really interesting guy who was a fundamentalist Christian who became a skeptic. And he actually publishes I think, the leading skeptic magazine. He started the Race Across America, too, the cross-country bike race. So he's had some weird paranormal experiences doing that. But he still doesn't believe in them. He still, you know. So he says, we have evolved brains that pay attention to anecdotes because false positives, in other words, believing there is a connection between A and B when there is not, are usually harmless, whereas false negatives, believing there is no connection between A and B when there is, may take you out of the gene pool, i.e. you die. So if you are, you know, a primitive hunter and you hear the rustle in the bushes, it could be the wind or it could be a tiger. If you just dismiss it and think, oh, it's the wind, you may die. And it's a tiger, you may die. If you think it's a tiger, but it's just the wind, all you have is some anxiety, right? You don't die. So it's, we're always in favor of assuming the worst, assuming the worst, assuming the worst. And it's very, very hard to get control of that. We always tend to magnify danger in our heads. I mean, that's just a normal thing. So you could call that a drawback of belief. It's in service of your genes, but it doesn't do much for you as a person trying to live your life day to day. And we're often ready to sacrifice our freedom for a feeling of safety, which can be damaging too, okay? Belief is a source of prejudice and delusion. So for instance, if you believe that you might believe that illegal immigrants are more likely to be rapists than thieves. The statistics show just the opposite. Nobody's going to go through all the trouble of getting into another country so they can earn some money and then commit a crime. If they commit a crime, they're going to do it in their own country. That kind of just makes common sense, right? But a lot of people believe because they're alien, they're foreign, they're scary, they must be more likely to commit crime. Or I just today I saw a very sad article on how black little girls are judged less innocent than the white ones. So when black mothers talk about, this one mother talking about putting her little girl in a little bathing suit and everybody remarking on how curvy she is and maybe you should cover her up a little more. Or the black kid in the school being the, you know, in the group of girls being the first to be blamed if drugs show up or something like that. So that's once again a belief that causes prejudice. And sometimes these beliefs are promoted by politicians to serve their own ends because if they make us scared and they say they can rescue us, then we want to vote for them, okay? Beliefs can blind us to actual threats or opportunities. A good example of that would be contraceptives. That if you believe the contraceptives are wrong because your God says so, then that keeps people, especially women, in a state of poverty for generations. You know, that they have to reduce the size of those families in order to be able to get out of poverty. And they don't. In fact, I was in San Cristobal this last weekend helping with a spay-neuter clinic to give village outreach of the spay-neuter clinic. And somebody was saying that in San Juan Cosala, the old priest had actually come out against the spay-neuter clinic because it wasn't even okay to do contraceptives for your dog. That if God wants those puppies to be born, they should be born. He was fine with chopping their heads off with machetes afterwards because there was no homes for them, which I thought was kind of weird. But anyway, another thing would be like your odds of drowning in a bathtub versus dying in a plane crash. None of us worry about drowning in a bathtub, but that's far more likely to happen. Worried about dying in a plane crash may keep you from traveling and enjoying, you know, traveling. Or whether you'd be killed, more likely to be killed by a terrorist or a handgun. And in the United States, far more likely to be killed by a toddler with a handgun than by a terrorist. And yet we have levels and levels and levels of security against terrorists, which are probably keeping us safer, I have to admit. But no laws whatsoever these days against handguns. Okay, and it can cause us to act in ways that actually harm us. So things like female genital mutilation, which is dictated by certain religions, which is very harmful. Certain kinds of alternative medicine, which some people may use instead of the thing that could have really helped them, which is, Phil has told good stories about how Steve Jobs died of something completely fixable because he tried alternative medicine first and finally went to traditional medicine when that didn't work and it was too late. Okay, and then beliefs are manipulated to gain control of people. You know, Marx said religion is the opiate of the masses. It's not just religion that keeps people calm so that they can be manipulated. It's any kind of patriotism, communism, any kind of, you know, belief system where the ideal is more important than the humanity, I guess. You know, that's, I mean, secular humanism is basically the thing that says taking care of humans is the most important thing. It's more important than any ideal. And another interesting thing is that, you know, advertisers use our lack of critical thinking to manipulate us into buying things. So, for instance, there was I can't remember which magazine it was, Forbes maybe, that had three subscription alternatives. It was for $160 you could get digital and print. For $160 again, you could get print only. For $50 you could get digital only. And when Harvard students were asked which one they would get, they went for the digital and print. It was like, well, it's the same price as the print. What a great deal. But when they eliminated the print only, I mean the digital and print, and it was print only or digital only, then most of them realized, I don't need the print. I will go with the digital only. So they put these decoys to get us thinking, well, man, that looks, you know, I'm comparing the three, and that looks like a really good deal. Even though they know nobody will buy that, because why would you buy just print when you could buy digital and print for the same price? Okay? So now I want to talk about thinking errors that lead to erroneous beliefs. So this is, I think, where it's really interesting to think about. We all do these things, you know. Don't think you can get yourself out of it, but the more you're aware of it, the more you can challenge yourself with your belief system, okay? So, first of all, to understand, we all have a mental construction of reality. Reality is what is in our heads. It's not out there for us personally, right? All your perceptions are filtered, and you're constructing your reality. It goes back to that old thing, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's around to hear it, did it make a sound? Well, obviously it put out the waves in the air, but unless there was an ear to interpret those into a sound, it didn't make a sound, right? The sound is in your ear and in your brain. It's not in the tree or in the air. That's just waves. And some other creature could have developed some other way of interpreting those, like just vibration or something that has nothing to do with sound. Okay, errors in perception. So now I'm going to pass around, and I don't think I have quite enough of these, but if some of you can share. And I'm going to have to look on one of them too. Okay, so the optical illusion is the classic thing that shows us how faulty our visual perception is. Okay, so the middle thing, the little chessboard with the cylinder on it, and the cylinder is casting a shadow. Okay, so is everybody looking at that? You can see a square marked A and a square marked B. Are they the same color? A and B?
Where are they?
I see B.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little hard to see. There's one marked A and one marked B.
Is that the same color?
Oh, yeah, I see A.
So are A and B the same color?
No, A is darker.
Yeah, A is darker. It sure looks like that.
They are the same color. They're the exact same color. Okay? Why is your brain telling you that one's lighter and one's darker? Because, and if you can, like, get your fingers so that you don't have all the context of the shadow and everything, you will see they are exact same color. Huh? No, it's not a chessboard thing. A and B are the same color. But our brain knows that B is in shadow, so it says, well, so for instance, if you look at the dark squares that are right next to the cylinder, those are actually darker than A.
Just fold it like this. Fold A into B.
And then you'll see,
as
soon as they touch each other, it's bizarre, isn't it? Okay, so A and B are the same color, but your brain is going, well, B is in shadow.
Right.
And so it must be a lighter color. The shadow is darkening it, okay? Right. Now that you know that A and B are the same color, you can easily see they're the same color, right?
No.
Your brain will not let it happen. Your unconscious mind is interfering and saying, sorry, those are different colors. One's in the shadow and one's in the light. Okay? And your brain is doing that to you all the time. Your unconscious mind is interpreting and filtering before it ever passes it on to your conscious mind. It's doing that in terms of whether you'll even notice something or won't notice something. So, you just have to accept your brain is pre-interpreting things for you. By the time it reaches your conscious mind, you don't even know what's going on. Okay, the next thing we have that's very, very common in humans is errors of memory. People think memory is like a tape recorder or a video camera that just puts a film in, you know, sticks a film in your head. That is not true. You construct your memories. And every time you remember it, you're essentially taking it out and reconstructing it and putting it back. And that's why it's so easy to give people false memories. It's frighteningly easy to give people false memories, okay? So if you find yourself arguing with a spouse or friend about an event in the past that you remember differently, and you're just going, no, it didn't happen that way, it happened this way. Take heart. Your spouse or friend is probably wrong about their memory, but you probably are too. None of us remember it exactly the way it really happened. We add context, we add, you know, our previous experiences, and it all dilutes it and mashes it up, and it becomes a, you know, your own personal memory. But it may have nothing, well, it may have something to do with what really happened, but it's not exactly what really happened. Which is why eyewitnesses are so fallible in a crime, right? They can be so easily led by interrogations with the police. So when I was reading about this, the guy had a cute anecdote that involved himself, who wrote, you know, I was reading about this in one of the books, and he said he had heard a story that illustrated something. He was a college professor. And so when he told the story to the class to illustrate this concept, not the concept of memory, it was a different concept, it had happened to a friend of his who had told him about it, but he changed it to himself because it was more interesting in the telling. And after he told it that way about 10 times, he was actually convinced that it really happened to him. He actually became fully convinced, and he only remembered differently when he told the story to the person who had originally told it to him, and they got very indignant and said, that didn't happen to you, that happened to me. And finally he was able to go, you know, think about it and remember, oh yeah, you know. But he had self-convinced that this thing had happened to him when it actually had completely happened to someone else. So don't trust your memory. Your memory is not accurate. Okay? Another thing is something called patternicity. Patternicity is something that happens. It's that idea of building that mental construct. Humans are very, very good at finding patterns. And patterns help us survive. Patterns help us, for instance, like I said before, recognize faces. And is this friend or foe? And what's the weather going to be? And is this something I can eat or is it something I don't? You know, and so you get all these cues from this thing you're looking at, you match them back against your past experience, and you see this pattern and you act on it, okay? But the problem is that we frequently see a pattern where there's really only random noise. It's a coincidence. And coincidence is very, very common. People don't really realize. So that's the top thing on the page, okay? Basically what we've got are three V's and three Pac-Man. Okay, we've got the little circle with the mouth. But what do you see? Does everybody see that white triangle in the middle?
Right.
That's right.
You can't unsee it. It's not there. There's no white triangle there. It's a pattern that your mind insists on you seeing, because of the context of all the other things. Okay? And that happens all the time. So that's where we get the face on Mars. Everybody know about the face on Mars? This, you know, photo that was taken by one of the satellites that looks like a face, and everybody's going, it proves there was a civilization on Mars. And people showed there's, you know, if you take it from different angles, the face completely disappears. It just happened to be at that time of day, the way the shadows were falling, it looks like a face. But there are still people who are completely convinced that was a face. And face is probably the number one thing that humans recognize, right? Face is, you know, you show a little baby two dots and a curved line and they stare at it much longer than they stare at other things. Okay? Virgin Mary in an oil stain. Okay? It's very convenient that our religious symbols have the flowing veils or the beard, the flowing hair, and all of that lends itself very well to anything that's kind of flowing down and out, you know, out slightly into a pattern. But of course you got people visiting those oil stains and lighting candles in front of those oil stains, okay? Another thing that patternicity creates is superstition. So I don't know how many of you have ever seen the superstitious pigeon videos. You ought to look them up on YouTube. What they did, and also all animals have superstition, What they did was they took a pigeon and trained it to peck at something to receive a reward. Okay? And then they mixed it up. They basically started giving the pigeon the reward at random intervals. All of a sudden it would just fall out. And I'm a dog trainer, so I know this happens exactly. With dogs, you can, you know, if you show them a pattern, they're trying to figure out what's happening. Why do I keep getting this reward? And they'll figure it out very fast without you ever, you know, giving them commands or anything. They figure it out literally in a couple of minutes. The pigeon would, for instance, if the pigeon happened to be flapping his wings a couple of times when that treat fell, the pigeon decides it must be the wing flapping that's giving me that treat. And pretty soon you'll have a pigeon that's just frenetically flapping its wings. If the pigeon was pecking the ground at the time the treat fell, the pigeon will decide it was the pecking the ground that made the treat fall. And remember, these treats are falling randomly. They are not in response to anything the pigeon is doing, but the pigeon has decided that this is the pattern. Every time I peck, one of these falls out, and pretty soon they're just constantly, okay, if they're constantly pecking, then what are the odds that the treat's going to fall while they're pecking? Okay? It's the same thing with humans. I was wearing this hat, and my team won 3 times in a row. Now I cannot go to the baseball game without wearing my hat. Oh my God, where's my hat? If I don't wear it, the team's going to lose. Okay? We're subject to that same thing, that same random reinforcement that becomes a pattern in our minds that we perceive as a pattern. Another thing that happens with patternicity is that we conflate correlation with causation. When two things correlate, we tend to say one caused the other. So for instance, you might say, well, most people or lung cancer is highly correlated with drinking alcohol. So drinking alcohol must cause lung cancer. What do you think is probably the real pattern?
People who drink smoke.
Or people who smoke tend to drink, or, you know, there tends to be a correlation there, and so that creates the correlation between alcohol and lung cancer, but it doesn't mean alcohol causes lung cancer. Now, they are doing investigations into whether there's some component of drinking alcohol that makes you more likely to get lung cancer, maybe if you already smoke, but you have to be very careful to not just assume that it's causation. Another one is there's a correlation between rates of violent crime and ice cream sales. It's very consistent. When ice cream sales go up, violent crimes go up. So ice cream must be causing the violent crime, right? What do you think is a more likely pattern? Hot weather. Hot weather makes people cranky. They buy more ice cream. They commit more crimes, right?
Watch out for that ice cream now.
Or just in the winter, they're all bundled up inside. They don't want to go out and commit crime or whatever. You know, so we see the pattern. And it's a real pattern, yes. You know, violent crimes and ice cream sales is a real pattern, but we mistakenly assume that there's a causation there. Just like the pigeon mistakenly assumed that pecking was causing the treat to fall, okay? Another thing is attributing agency and feelings to non-living things, which we as humans do compulsively. There's something called theory of mind that we have, and it's been pretty much proven that other animals have it, which is the ability to imagine what another person is thinking or seeing, okay? And it doesn't develop in kids till about 3 or 4 years old. But consider, for instance, did anybody see the movie with Tom Hanks, Survivor, was that what it was called, or whatever? It was Castaway?
Castaway.
Yeah. Where he was on the island, yeah. And Wilson the volleyball.
Yeah.
And when Wilson floated away, I was sniffly. You know, and it wasn't just that I knew he was in agony over Wilson. He really had got this feeling like, oh God, Wilson's drowning, save Wilson. You know, because it's so easy for us to transfer feelings onto that. I don't think the skeptic here did, but I did. And that's why you can have movies like, Herbie the Love Bug. That's why people develop relationships with Siri on their phone, you know. They feel like you're talking to a real human. And another really interesting thing is with babies, if you show them a video of two random dots moving around, they pay it little attention. But if you make it so that one dot looks like it's chasing the other, they become very focused on it. Okay, so they're at that point, they're attributing the agency to those dots. This one's trying to catch the other one. Of course, we don't know what babies are thinking, but it's very interesting that they suddenly, it's like, you know, something's happening there and I'm interested in it. And so it's natural for people to think the universe has agency. right? That's God, essentially. It's a universe with agency, you know, to attribute purpose and meaning and, you know, intention to the universe. In other, like the more primitive religions, or what I would call, you know, religions of primitive people, I wouldn't call them primitive religions. Maybe rocks and trees have agency, they're spirits, things have agency, things have purpose and intention, okay? Okay, another one that's really good is not understanding probability. So, if somebody has just tossed a coin in front of you 9 times and it's come up heads every time, what are the odds it's going to come up tails the next time?
First, examine the coin.
Yeah, okay. Assuming it's a completely normal non-trick coin.
50-50
every time. If they've just tossed it 99 times and it's come up heads, what are the odds?
50-50.
But don't you kind of get a feeling that tails has got to be coming up now? You know? Okay? So, and a lot of people do. We have very intelligent friend that he's had this argument with him again and again and again, and he's sure, no. In order for it to even out to 50-50, that tails has got to come up, okay? And that's a lot of just a misunderstanding of infinity. What is infinity? After infinity times, it's going to be 50-50. You know, is 100 close to infinity? No. Is 1,000 close to infinity? No. 1,000,000? No. You know, it's 50-50. Okay, so what about this? Which of these patterns is more likely in 6 tosses of the coin? Heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails. Heads, 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 or heads, tails, tails, heads, heads.
They're all the same.
Okay? People tend to feel like the more random pattern is more likely. But the pattern, the heads, tails, is just as likely. So if you know somebody who's betting on the lottery and they pick their numbers because this is my birthday and my kid's birthday and the day I got married and blah, 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 you can say, well, you might as well bet on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 because that's exactly the same odds of coming up. And then you start to realize how unlikely it is that your numbers are ever going to come up. Okay? But people, you know, they don't think that way. They think that, you know, if the roulette wheel has gone, you told the story of the roulette wheel that's gone like 36 times on red, everybody's betting on black because it's got to go to black, you know, and this is emptying people's pockets. This is why casinos are in business, right? Okay, the next one is not understanding physical phenomena or scientific explanations, okay? So, for instance, not understanding that your body usually gets well on its own. Otherwise, the human race would have never survived because we didn't have modern medicine back then. It usually gets well on its own. I remember the Beverly Hillbillies? An episode of the Beverly Hillbillies in which Granny supposedly had a cure for the common cold, and Mr. Drysdale was desperate to get this because he knew it would make him a fortune. And so he did some ridiculous things to, you know, that she asked him to do to get it from her. And so she gives it to him and says, you know, do this and do this, and in a week to 10 days you'll be cured. Okay? So as far as she was concerned, those things she was doing was what was curing the cold. And that's very common. But like I said, I believe in evolution, and the main thing I find when I talk to people who don't believe in it is they don't understand it. So I've heard evolution, for instance, referred to as survival of the strongest. It's not. It's survival of the fittest. You know, and you can be very fit without being strong. A cockroach is extremely fit for its niche. But we can squish it by stepping on it, but it's extremely fit for its niche, okay? People ask, why do monkeys still exist? You know, if evolution happened, why are there still monkeys? Not understanding, you know, the branches of the, you know, the things that happen. How can a new species ever happen? You know, because each parent gives birth to its own species. How can a new species ever happen? And talking to Jehovah's Witness, I was saying, well, let's say you had a computer screen with 1,000,000 pixels, and every second one of those pixels changes, it's bright, it's completely red, every second one of those pixels changes to blue. In 11 days, the screen is entirely blue, a pixel at a time. Are you going to look at that and tell me that screen's still red? Because every pixel, it only changed a pixel at a time? No, after millions of years, the thing that's existing now is a completely different species than the things that existed before. Okay? I told you about the guy who said we can't fly to the moon because the Earth is moving at 76,000 miles an hour. 1,000 miles an hour. Okay, then another, where, how much time do we have? Am I like gone way over already? No, I'm okay? All right.
People try to leave, then you know you're...
Okay. We have survivorship bias and the influence of luck. Phil's done a whole talk on survivorship bias, which basically says, if 10 people did something in a similar way, and 9 of them failed, and 1 of them succeeded, we only hear from the one who succeeded. So we try to copy what they did, not knowing that it's 90% likely to fail. You know, essentially. And so we keep listening to the people who succeeded and thinking that's the way to do it, not realizing that that exact same way failed 90% of the time, or however many. And that's like stock market investing. Like, oh, I'm an expert on stock market investing. Most stock market investors just got lucky. And they think they're experts and they're out there to give you advice, and it turns out they just got lucky, and, you know, you could lose all your money. Not knowing what we don't know, the Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. This is the idea that the more that you're an amateur or beginner, the more you're unaware of the standards of performance for an activity, so you overrate your own performance. So I used to do technical interviews. I programmed in Java, and I used to do technical interviews for the company I worked for, and the first thing I'd ask them is rate yourself as a Java programmer, your skill level on 1 to 10. And if they said 7 or 8, I pretty much knew they were an amateur. Because they hadn't been gotten into the language enough to realize how huge it was. So they assumed because they knew this piece, they knew almost all there was to know. The true experts, I could always confirm it by giving them technical questions, but the true experts rated themselves at about 6. You know, my best programmers rated themselves at about 6 because they knew how big it was. The only people who could ever go up to 7 or 8 to me are the pundits who's just studied it for a living, basically, and tried to keep up with everything. So that's the Dunning-Kruger effect. Trump is a perfect example of the Dunning-Kruger effect. He assumes he knows everything about everything because he really knows nothing, okay? So I don't know if I'm just insulting anybody here, but... Okay? And another thing, like with people, when I was learning Spanish, with people I'm helping learn Spanish, as beginners, they're going along and they're thinking, wow, I'm doing really well. And then the more they know, the more they go, oh, I don't know this language at all. Because the more they encounter how difficult it is to learn it and how, you know... complex the language is. Then there's confirmation bias. Okay? Confirmation bias is that we're all heroes of our own story. So, for instance, in your house, if you're looking at some bad habit that your spouse has, you know, you tend to see all the times that they did it, but you don't tend to see all the times you did it. You know, and so everything you see confirms your belief that they're the one always doing this because you're not seeing the times that you do it. You know, or you essentially see on the internet only the stories, you only read the stories that agree with what you feel. And that's things like Facebook have really made that worse because they deliberately feed you the stuff that you've read before. And so you never see the other side of the story. Okay? Hindsight bias, the I knew it all along effect. And because of those memories of ours, we adjust our memories accordingly. We didn't know it, but we adjust our memories to think we did know it, and so we overestimate our own ability to predict something in the future. Okay, the decoy effect I talked about, like giving you where the advertising gives you the 3 choices in order to make you go for the more expensive one. Over-attributing. So for instance, if you think, if this herbal remedy really does work, then all the other herbal remedies must work. Herbal must just be a good thing. So that's over-attributing. Our preference for anecdotal evidence. Human beings much prefer a good story and will believe in a good story than in statistics. And politicians take advantage of that all the time. You know, the one that sunk Dukakis. You know, I think they asked him, you know, what if your wife was raped, or I can't, you know.
Really
important, yeah. And it was just an anecdote. It had nothing to do statistically, but it sunk his campaign, and that happens all the time. The left hemisphere interpreter, okay, so the left hemisphere is the part of your brain that wants to create a story about everything. And so it gives you a reason for everything you do, but the reason may actually be buried in your unconscious and you don't know why you did it. But you'll come up with one. And Phil's also talked about people's brains like being electrically stimulated in certain parts to make them like move their hand. Why'd you move your hand? Oh, I thought there was a fly on it. You know, it was the electrical stimulation that made him move it, but they're not going to go, God, I don't know, it just moved. Your brain doesn't work that way. It wants a reason why you moved, and so it comes up with one. You know, so it's always explaining things after the fact in a way that's agreeable to you, but may have nothing to do with reality. Our ability to rationalize, to, you know, even though we do something, oh, I'll eat this donut now and run 3 miles tomorrow or whatever, you know. But I'm really on a diet. I am on a diet. I'm eating donuts, but I'm going to run 3 miles tomorrow, okay. Our pride in not being fooled, okay. So that's where conspiracy theories come from, you know. If you go watch, you know, that lunar landing again, you can see the flag is rippling and there's no air on the moon, so how is it rippling? You know, now I've never investigated to see where the flag is rippling, but it could be they just hung it and it was still falling, or who knows. The if it feels good, believe it. Okay, so I have this belief. I believe in guardian angels, and it feels good to me, so I'm going to go on believing it. I don't really care whether it's true or not. And sometimes that's harmless, but sometimes it's not. And there's a bunch of others. Okay, there's a bunch of other. If you just go looking into it, thinking errors, or look on some of these books on critical thinking, I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating, and it does help me look at my own thinking. But I still know my brain's fooling me all the time. Okay. So, the one other thing you have on your sheet, this is for your blind spot. Okay. So this is part of patternicity. So what you do is you hold it out and close your left eye and look at the cross with your right eye and gradually bring it forward. I'm trying to find the spot where the circle disappears. And it helps if you kind of hold it over to the right a little bit. And so I'm at about a foot, maybe 14 inches away from my face. What you'll find is that the circle, it is at that point in your retinal blind spot. The circle has moved into your retinal blind spot. But you don't just see a hole there, you see a line. It continues the pattern of the line. Okay, because your brain wants to fill it in. It just goes, well, what's most logical? I see this line, it's probably a line. And it, mentally, your brain fills it in even though there's nothing in front of your eye at that point. So are you guys able to do that? Mm-hmm. You might have to tinker with it a little bit, but you'll find a point where, like, I'm right here, where the circle disappears, but the line looks continuous. You don't see a hole in it. Okay, so that's another way where your brain is filling in patterns. It's seeing patterns that aren't there because it doesn't want gaps. Okay, so I'm just wrapping up, thank God. So I'm going to talk about critical thinking skills, that you might want to take forward. So the first one is to understand your limitations. Beware of your critical thinking flaws, like I've just named, okay? You have flaws in perception. Your perception is not that good. Your memory is not that good. You know, constantly be aware of that. You're susceptible to anecdote. So you're, you know, it's like, well, I don't really believe in ghosts, but my friend told me a really convincing story, so now I'm wondering, okay? And so does that one story eliminate everything that I've ever known about the way reality works? You know, sometimes it does, because we're very susceptible to anecdote. Okay, and all these other things I talked about. The more you become aware of these, the more, if you want to really think about something critically, you can apply, you know, and say, am I suffering from confirmation bias here, or am I applying the survivorship bias, or all these, the halo effect, or the hindsight effect, okay? Another thing is to try on other points of view, okay? And we tend to not want to do that. We tend to want to keep arguing for our own point of view, and it's really hard to do. And so the idea is to be your own devil's advocate, to think of the best arguments against your own beliefs and see if your belief still holds up, okay? So, for instance, transgender bathrooms. Okay, when I was first hearing the arguments against transgender bathrooms, I thought, this is stupid. Transgender people don't go in and molest, you know, the transgender man to woman does not go in and molest the little girls. In fact, I'd be more scared of the transgender woman to man, who is now a man, coming into the woman's bathroom. But if you think about a really valid argument is, a woman might be saying, well, okay, I walk into the women's bathroom and there's a man standing in there. So I go get the security guard and say, can you get this guy out of here? And the security guard goes in, and the guy goes, hey, I identify as a woman. I got every right to be in here. So now you have a problem, don't you? Okay, so that's interesting. Does that change my belief? I don't know if it does or not, but I can understand that there's more to it than just worry that transgender people are going to molest people. There's, you know, it's more complicated than that. Or the healthcare debate. Okay, I happen to believe in single payer, but if I talk to very conservative friends about this, one of the arguments is, okay, yes, I think it'd be very nice for somebody to pay for that baby's, you know, heart care or whatever, but why should the rich people have to do it? It's their money. Why should we go and force rich people to pay for the baby's heart care? Why should I have to do it? It's, you know, it's my money. So, you know, if you really want to hold on to your belief, you have to come up with some rational answer to that, right? Okay, identify your emotional investment and your current biases. So, I'm part of a tribe. I'm progressive. I believe in progressive things. I liked Obama. I didn't want to hear about bad things Obama did. I don't want to hear about good things Trump does. You know, I'm taking these biases. And sometimes, you have to look very hard to get past them. Check in with other people. You know, see if your opinion, if they can give you more feedback on reality. Develop a better understanding of probability. So the more you know about probability and statistics, and everybody here passed pretty well, you know, on probability, but there's a lot of people that don't. Practice distinguishing between correlation and cause-effect. It's really important when you're reading media reports on health studies, because they'll take any minor correlation, and the headline will be X causes Y, when maybe there's just been a minor correlation identified. Gather more information and consider the source, okay? Avoid naive relativity. I can't remember what I meant by that. I meant something, but I forgot to put notes. Deliberate. Okay, here's a question. Answer as quick as you can. You may have heard this one. I have a bat and a ball. Together they cost $1.10. The bat cost $1. How much did the ball cost?
5 cents.
Knew it. What's your first response?
10 cents.
Okay. Okay, so it's 10 cents and the bat's a dollar. Is that a dollar more than 10? No. You know, you have to start, you know, but that's your, and 50% of Harvard students gave 10 cents as the answer when they were forced to answer rapidly. So step back and deliberate. Make sure that, you know, you got the right answer. And then distrust over elaborate or inelegant explanations. Okay, so for instance, I was reading about flat earth as part of this. I thought, how do they explain flat earth? How do they explain all the discrepancies, okay? So, first they're saying it's flat, and there's an ice wall that holds in the ocean. So if you look at it, there's an ice wall all the way around that holds in the ocean. We call this Antarctica. Nobody has ever crossed it, so we don't know what's beyond. In fact, a bunch of people have crossed Antarctica, but of course they're not going to believe that. It's not possible to cross it because it's a wall. It's not a continent, okay? We all know some stars are visible from the southern hemisphere and not from the northern hemisphere, but the reason behind this is that electromagnetic and optical acceleration through an etheric whirlpool keeps the people in the... Okay? What does that even mean? But it sounds so impressive and scientific, right? Furthermore, barrel distortion and other quirks of modern cameras will cause a picture to distort in ways which may not be immediately obvious or apparent, especially without references within the picture. Photographs are also prone to distortion when taken through the bent glass of a pressurized cabin as well as atmospheric conditions on the outside. That's how they explain that when you're up in a plane, you can actually see the curve. Nope, it's an atmospheric distortion. With this litany of problems, it's easy to see why photographic evidence is not to be trusted. Okay, so they even explain the fact that the Earth looks spherical from the space shuttle by photographic distortion. Okay, now how they explain that you can actually fly across Antarctica and see it going under you as a continent instead of a wall, I'm sure they've explained that away somehow. You know, but there's super elaborate weird explanations. Gravity is due to continuous acceleration. This disk is continuously accelerating, and that's why we have gravity. And they even have an explanation of once it reaches, why it can exceed the speed of light, why it can be never stop accelerating. The sun is a spotlight 3,500 miles away. Where it shines, they have light. Where it doesn't, it's dark. So it goes, this circle of light kind of goes around like this. Okay? And we all know the scientific method, I think we all know, is scary. Is the way that humans have tried to overcome what they know are their thinking errors and their conceptual errors. And so that's why we use, it's not a perfect method, because we're human, but it's the best that we have. Science isn't a collection of facts, it's a method. So if you say science says, you know, the climate is changing, science doesn't say that. Science says here are ways to test and find out whether it is. You know, that's all it says. And then it might come to a conclusion, but it always leaves open the possibility that if better evidence comes up, we will change our conclusion. That's science, okay? So it uses control groups, because you don't want survivorship bias, right? Control groups eliminate survivorship. It includes double blind, so you don't get confirmation bias, where you see what you expect to see. You've got people who don't know what they expect to see, so they can report that. It uses testing to make the hypothesis fail. It just doesn't say, well, that sounds good, let's go with that, okay? And it uses repeatability. It has to be able to be repeated, and it uses peer review so other people can point out any flaws in your thinking. It could be easily corrupted by if the scientist is in somebody's pocket or has their own pet theory or wants to get suddenly famous, like the autism vaccine guy who has admitted that he made it up, and yet we can't get that to go away. So I think I've run over my time, but that's it.
Could you send me those notes and I'll put them online for you?
Okay. Yeah. And so something I thought would be interesting for discussion is, you know, how has the internet affected and media affected people's beliefs? I really believe it's divided us into camps.
Before that, can I ask a question? Mathematics is an objective.
Is it a science?
Not really. Yeah. No, it's an object. How would you describe it?
It's a way of thinking.
But it's the ultimate in objectivity, right?
Supposedly.
This is where the Council for Defence raises it. But it's not subjective, right?
Right, it's not subjective.
And yet someone here, I won't mention their names, convinced is not a word, told us that you could take a ball and through just mathematical manipulation create a second. Now, as this was based on objective methodology, is that true or not?
It's true mathematically.
Well, it's like how the arrow never reaches its target.
It actually depends on an axiom that is controversial in mathematics called the axiom of choice, which some people believe, and some people don't believe. But it's a controversial axiom, because it's the only axiom in all of mathematics that isn't constructive, which means you can't use it to make the thing you're talking about. Uh-huh. So because of that, it has some very strange consequences, one of which is this idea that you can take a ball and break it into five pieces, rearrange them, and you have two balls exactly the same size with no gaps. This is a true statement if you go along with the axiom of choice.
And I think about 3% believe that.
Actually, the axiom of choice is very big in mathematics. 97%.
And is there a difference between faith and belief? I don't know. Is it the same thing?
It's similar.
Well, some people say that faith doesn't require evidence. So I would say belief encompasses faith, but belief also encompasses things that do have evidence.
Yeah,
I see. Faith is something that can't be destroyed by evidence.
But certainly faith is a type of belief, but it's a belief without evidence.
Yeah. So, whereas belief usually can be, if the person is somewhat objective.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I want I want to say I really enjoyed your talk.
Oh, good.
And it really opened my eyes to a lot of things. Uh-huh. I mean, I knew that I hadn't heard them formulated this way.
Uh-huh.
And it was really great. I thank you very much
for
putting it all together.
And the Cottingley Fair, I didn't live far from Cottingley in Yorkshire. The Cottingley story was finally the sisters themselves explained what they did decades after.
Wow.
And they were still believing it, you know, when they were in their 60s.
Well, you remember the spaghetti harvest that they had too, right?
On the trees?
On the trees. Yeah. I believe that.
When I was a teenager, the local radio station was the April Fool's Day joke. Said they developed something called electro-odoronics, which where they could transmit smells by the radio. And so they really built it up. They talked about it all day, and then at the end of the day, they had the sound of an old percolating coffee pot. And they said, okay, now we're turning it on, and now it's transmitting. And people were calling going, I smell it. It's so strong. It's all around me. And then finally they went, April Fools, you know.
There's a story about Freud who had hypnotized somebody and said, you're going to go out on the balcony and open your umbrella. And so when the guy woke up, he went out on the balcony and opened his umbrella, and Freud said, why did you do that? And he said, well, because it was raining.
Yeah.
And it wasn't.
Yeah.
So that's the, where you have, your mind makes up stuff to explain what you did.
They did a lot of studies with the split brain patients where they sever the corpus callosum to prevent epilepsy. And then you can, if you give things to like one side of your eye, the one side of the brain sees it, but the other side of the brain knows nothing about it. And so they would show them, for instance, a word on one side of the brain. And that side of the brain doesn't know words, but it knows shapes. It could recognize it later if it saw it. And then they start showing the other eye words and say, stop me at one of these words. And the person would always pick the word that had been flashed inside the brain. They said, why did you stop me at that word? And they always had a story. They didn't say, I don't know. Well, because it reminded me of this, or because I was thinking about that, or, you know, they always had a story.
Niels Bohr had a horseshoe over his door. And some other famous scientists were surprised and said, well, you don't believe in horseshoes bringing you luck. He says, no, but it brings you luck whether you believe in it or not.
I have friends that show me photographs with orbs.
Uh-huh, yeah.
What the hell? It's just a flash, right? I mean, I know it's not an orb, but I have a tremendous number of friends that when they see a light flash in the photograph, they believe there was some spirit in that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to tell them, it's like, it's your flash. It was the shining off the light.
The way the lens.
They are completely
distorts the light.
That. And then I had a lady tell me that ever since her daughter was little, those orbs have been in those photographs all her life. And I'm like, God, I'd love to see that.
Get a new camera.
And the more, the more photographs she brought out, she was like, well, I know it was there. She simply
confirmation bias, absolutely.
That they were there every single time.
Yeah, and then she adjusted her memory accordingly. See, all of those biases fit into that story. Yeah. But people have had, I read a Michael Shermer book on the believing brain. Michael Shermer's books are very good. And he starts it with a story of a guy who had essentially a spiritual experience. It was really a psychotic break. He ended up in a mental hospital. Where a voice came to him and said, everything is love. Love is the most important thing. And it made it, you know, and then it stopped. And then he immediately started trying to communicate with the president. Because he said, it's very important that this voice has told me this and I've got to tell the president. And he got arrested by the Secret Service and all this because he wouldn't stop. And so Shermer's interviewing him and saying, do you really think this happened? He says, I don't know, but I feel like it did. And Rasa Partis Mike could step away and say, I'm not really sure whether it happened, but my gut says it did. And he had to act on it, you know? And there was essentially nothing that would convince him. There's a really interesting mental illness where people believe that everything in a room has been replaced by exact duplicates. And that desk is not their desk. Somebody has replaced it. Well, it looks exactly like your desk. I know, but it's not my desk. There's some part of their brain that's going, that's not mine. Well, look, it's got this scratch in it. You did that scratch. Not my desk. And some people, even with people, will believe that all their family has been replaced by exact duplicates.
Parallel universe.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's weird things that the brain can do, where it's like they know, they completely acknowledge it looks exactly like, well, why do you think it's different? I just do. Well, that is not her.
They believe that about their body parts, too.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes if you lose sensation, it's like, that's not my leg.
Well, even the guy, Oliver Sacks.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He had an accident with his leg.
Uh-huh.
And he was, after the surgery, he was totally convinced that was not his...
Somebody had left an amputated leg.
It was attached to his body, but yeah. It was not his leg.
Yeah.
I've had patients where they've thrown the leg out of bed.
Out of bed, and they went...
They followed,
yeah.
It
fell out.
It was a strange leg in the bed. Yeah.
What was that?
Oh, phantom limbs.
You can show them there's nothing there.
Oh, yeah, the phantom limb.
Yeah.
You know, phantom limb is like your brain still wants to receive sensations, but there's nothing there, and so it's inventing stuff. Sure. You're essentially inventing a limb. And these people have to, you know, like, it's very, very common for people who've had an amputation to feel like the thing is contracted. And you know about the mirror therapy, where they have the person put their good hand, and then they have a mirror here, so it looks like their other hand is there, and they ask them to imagine that they put the phantom limb in the other side of the box in that position. And then they look in the mirror and they move this hand, and their brain interprets it as that they're moving the other hand, and they can relieve the contracture. You know? And sometimes it takes many sessions, and it doesn't work for everybody, but it's like, compared to other therapies, it's like a miracle. Because they try drugs and everything, and they don't work.
Have you heard of the other weird phenomenon, I don't know the name of it, where people see themselves without legs or without arms and actually have elective surgeries? There was a woman's story that I read, it's been a year at least, she had already had part of her leg removed, and she saw herself as having both legs removed, so she actually injured herself, and they fixed her leg, and so she injured again and then put ice on it and just kept it at home until it actually turned to gangrene so that they would have to cut her leg off. I don't know the name
Never
of this,
heard
but
of that.
This is like, yeah, please look it up because...
But there is something called blindsight, mm-hmm. where they've examined their eyes, the eyes are functioning perfectly, they're saying, I can't see. Mm-hmm. But if you put them in a hallway with obstacles and send them down it, they will avoid every obstacle. But they will swear they couldn't see a thing the whole time they were walking. So it's like the brain is saying you can't see, but another part of the brain is going, oh, go to the left, oh, go to the left. Yeah, it's super, super interesting. It's, you know, I just think, for me, it's really important to understand how easy it is to have flawed thinking.
If only we had free will.
Yeah. But see, now that you've been exposed to this, it starts to become incorporated into your unconscious thought process.
Yeah. No choice.
No choice, Andy.
So what do you have to say, Gary, about science?
It's just like the polls you said there. We are 50%, 80% of that. When are we going to learn that the polls lie?
That what lies?
They lie. Like, look at the last elections. All the polls were...
Oh, polls. Yeah, the polls.
The polls?
They don't lie. They just don't sample very well.
Yeah.
I read an article about how many people would have to have been sampled in order to predict Trump's victory in a couple of the states. And they basically would have had to have a sample size many thousands of times larger than what they have, in order to get the accuracy they needed by the small number of votes that was...
They try to randomize, but it's really hard.
It's
so it's not that the method is wrong, but it's that sometimes it's impossible to execute it.
Right. If the differences are so small, statistically, the sample size needs to be so huge to find that discrepancy, that's just not practical to do it. So the polls can often be wrong, even though they were done correctly.
Yeah, but... Take the states out of the equation. You look at
Canada elections, British elections, New Zealand elections, Australian elections in the last 6 years, the polls have been 100% wrong. Like in Canada last
night. What poll came up with that figure?
It's still the same explanation.
If it's close, it is difficult.
But if it's 100% wrong about
If it's close, it's like, you know, the tails. Yeah, but you know, they're all wrong until one of them's right.
Close in horseshoes.
Yeah, polling is not a very exact science. Or it's just something like you say, it's impractical to do.
You've got to recognize its limitations.
Yeah.
Well, there was a book out called Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics.
But I remember back in Canada, you know, I'm from New Zealand originally. And
you remember, Gary?
I had to go there to help the Canadians. Every time, it must have been half a dozen times, it could be four, but I'm saying half a dozen, I remember. A pollster would phone. You know what time they phone? At dinner time.
Yeah.
All the time. I only take 5 minutes. I'm having dinner. I only take 5 minutes. Okay, I'm going to ask you 10 questions. Yeah, thank you, bye. You know, you're not going to, you're peed off of them, they've phoned at the time when you want to sit down and relax and have something to eat. I don't know if you've experienced that.
But that doesn't invalidate the scientific method. That invalidates the polling method.
No, but the scientists would come along and say, because 10 of them believe it, it would be scientifically proven until it's proven wrong.
Well, like I say,
Remember Truman holding up the big newspaper, Dewey wins.
Yeah.
Right? That was all on polling,
too. Yeah, but everything, I mean, humans are going to make mistakes, no matter how good the method is. You know, but it's still the best that we have. We're still constantly trying to get closer to the truth.
Just like the parliamentary, the British parliamentary system. It's the best we've had. It's the best we've got.
Who was it who said democracy is a horrible form of government and everything else is worse?
But you know, in terms of polling politics and polling your belief in God, whether you're in the middle of dinner or not, you're going to give a consistent answer. So, you know, anything that's trivial to you, your responses are not going to be that accurate. Anything that is fundamental to your core belief is going to be a lot more accurate.
Right? Yeah, but usually they say they only poll, 1,500 at a time?
Sample size is always a problem.
It's 1,500 and they're 24 million?
It's a balance between practicality
and math. It also depends a lot on how they ask the question.
Oh, yeah,
they can manipulate any response they want by slanting the question in the right way.
Yeah. What was the one that was surprising you? Was it the British?
The
moon. It's because we don't trust anything Americans say.
You quoted, which I found strange, you said 80% of Americans believe in God, and yet I've seen other things online, of course that doesn't mean much, that says that roughly 60% of Americans are secular, or don't believe in God. And it's one of the fastest growing segments of the population.
I have a hard time believing it's that big. But once again, it's like when I was doing research, I tried to find at least two or three sources that said pretty much the same thing. But
you had the word personal in there, and it changes a lot.
Oh, okay. That would be true. Right.
Worldwide, you're definitely right. Mm-hmm. A worldwide poll, only 4% of Japanese people believe in God. And, you know, you go to the Scandinavian countries and it's very small percentages.
Sure.
In Britain, I think it's about 50. You know, by the time you get to USA, it's gone up to 80 or 90. USA is still a very...
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
See, if the university asked the question, just, you know, when you know you're dying, you know, you might be an atheist and all this, or you just believe in spiritualism. But you're dying, you know, do you believe in God? Yeah, I think so, because you want to cover bases.
But do you believe it? You know, God knows whether you really do.
You should listen to Christopher Hitchens' talk about, you know, when he was diagnosed with throat cancer and he said every theist, every religious person was going to say, well, now we'll see a change in your belief. And he was adamant right to the end. You're not going to get me to compromise my beliefs just on a hope and a prayer.
Thank you, Linda.
Very good. Sandy.
Thank you. Does anybody want a copy of Handmaiden?
I've seen it all, but I would recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, you can download it. But I think it's on.
What do you think?
No, it's not on Amazon.
It's on HBO.
Yeah. It's outstanding, and it is.
What is it called?
It's called The Handmaid's Tale.
I couldn't watch it. It's horrible.
It's essentially
the Taliban in America.
It's a little too close.
And it's like, this could happen. I cannot watch
it. That was the problem.
It was very plausible.
It's happening.
It was a fiction. It was essentially the equivalent if the Taliban took over America.
No, not the Taliban.
The current Christian
what I'm saying, it has really happened in the world. When the Taliban took over Iran, that's the exact equivalent of what's happened in The Handmaid's Tale. It really happened.
Right.
It could happen today.
And I couldn't watch it.
If you look at the pictures in Iran, 1950s, 1960s, it looked a very westernized, very cosmopolitan, westernized.
It can happen. My family was supposed to go there in the 60s.
It can happen. That's the most scary thing.
Scary.
See you. Thank you. Thanks for holding
the meeting. We got to pay. Did you pay more?